The body of 34-year-old Nicole Brown Simpson, ex-wife of O.J. Simpson, was found after midnight on the sidewalk outside her West Los Angeles home. Next to it, the body of an unidentified 26-year-old man. Both had apparently been stabbed. The bodies of Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman were discovered early Monday morning. Later, a police forensics team began a search of the crime scene and O.J. Simpson's home. Investigators removed several pieces of evidence from both properties. A blood-soaked glove, according to the Los Angeles Times, found at O.J. Simpson's home and believed used during the killings. A second newspaper reports the matching glove was found at the crime scene. Late this afternoon, the L.A. County Coroner's Office released partial autopsy results. They indicate that both Mrs. Simpson and Ronald Goldman died of multiple sharp force injuries and stab wounds. Police are also still awaiting the results of forensic tests on items collected at the crime scene and at O.J. Simpson's home.
So June 12, 1994, that was a monumental day in L.A. history, American history. I do know that, you know, most people are aware of the key parts of the case, you know, the Bronco chase and the trial and everything, but I think what interests me the most is the actual night, June 12th, 1994, and into June 13th, 1994, of the timeline and the events and what we know happened, you know, based on phone records, based on interviews. Can say what you will about the trial and what went on at that point, and all the back and forth and all the controversy of that, but the key elements are that night and into the morning of June 13th and midday, of course, and everything within that week, I think, is pretty key. So I think that the events of the night begin at Paul Revere Middle School. I think that's where it's important to start the night, just my opinion, because we have the first piece of footage that helps timeline the case, right? We have the home video shot outside of Paul Revere Middle School where you see OJ hugging and kissing, you know, Lewis and Judy Brown, picking up Justin and giving him a kiss and just, you know, talking to people. Now, Sydney had a recital that night. The recital as a whole started at 4:30. I've read that it took about 90 minutes to get to Sydney's performance. So I would guesstimate that that famous home video of OJ outside was taken probably just after 6, as OJ did testify that they left after her performance. OJ got to the recital just after 5, and then he realized he forgot flowers for Sydney, so he leaves the recital, goes to a local florist, returns to the recital with flowers for her. During that time, him and Nicole were not speaking. She did have a ticket for him, which she handed to Denise. Denise then handed it to OJ. OJ did not sit with the group. He grabbed his own chair, and he went and sat in the corner of the auditorium. As you can tell from the famous home video footage that was shot, Nicole wasn't there. You know, it was her family, it was OJ's friends and the kids. So I would say that's roughly after 6 o'clock.
Okay, we're here at Paul Revere Middle School, and everyone's seen the famous footage of OJ and the family here during Sydney's recital. It all took place in this area here. This is it. I believe they were standing somewhere in this area there, by the fencing, by the wrought iron there.
Cato Kalin.
What was the very next time you saw the defendant that day?
I believe it was after the recital.
About what time was that?
I'm guessing about 6:30, 7, around there. The exact time I don't know, but I think it's about...
Around 7?
Yeah, the playoff games ended. That's all, I remember that.
And what playoff game was that?
Houston and the Knicks. But so it was after that. It's about 6:37.
Do you have a conversation with the defendant?
Yes.
About what?
I asked how the recital was, and how Sydney was, and she was great.
Is that what he said? She was great?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes, she was great.
You have to say yes and no, because this lady does not have a button for mm-hmm. Okay?
You should get one.
Hey, what was the defendant's mood like at that point, about 7 o'clock?
Not upbeat, not downbeat. I thought he was tired.
Did he seem relaxed?
Yes.
Make any mention of Nicole?
At the second conversation?
Yes, at about 7 o'clock. Did the defendant mention anything to you about Nicole?
That you saw her at the dance recital.
And what else did he say?
That her and a friend, they were wearing tight outfits.
And it make was, some mention about that? Make some comment about that?
It was a comment of being able to dress that way when they're older.
And what was his tone of voice? Was it angry?
No.
What was it?
Kind of matter of fact.
What was he saying? He wondered how they'd look in those outfits when they got older?
Yes.
Was that it? I'm asking it was, you.
Oh, it was the exact wording, I don't know, was if they're going to be grandmas, they can't wear those outfits. Something like that. So, when they're older.
Okay. So you spoke to the defendant for how long at that point?
I don't know the exact how many minutes. About a half hour.
Okay. What happened after that?
I asked if I could take a jacuzzi.
And did he say yes?
Yes.
Did you do that?
Yes.
And for how long did you stay in the jacuzzi?
I stayed in there about a half hour.
Had you ever used the jacuzzi before?
No.
Was that the first time?
Yeah, I mean, I swam in it once before, but I never actually used it, sat in it to use it.
How long did you stay in the jacuzzi?
I think it was about a half hour.
So you got out about when?
I think when I got out of there, it was about 8:30. About.
And after you got out of the jacuzzi, what did you do next?
I made a phone call.
To who?
To a friend named Susan.
And while you were on the phone, did you have contact, when you were on the phone with Susan, did you have contact with someone else?
No, I don't think it was.
Did you see the defendant while you were on the phone with Susan?
No. I think it was after he came to my room.
The defendant came to your room?
Yes.
And what did he say to you?
That I forgot to turn the jacuzzi off.
And by that time, were you still on the phone with Susan? Or were you had you hung up?
I think I hung up.
And what did the defendant say to you?
To remember to turn off the jacuzzi next time I use it. And he asked me if I was done with the jacuzzi, and I said, yes, I'm done. Sorry, I didn't turn it off.
And did you come out of your room to say that to him, to have that conversation?
I was at my doorway, I believe.
Where was he?
Outside the door.
How many feet away were you from each other?
I think 3 feet.
Did you notice any injury to his hands or that he was bleeding from his hands in any way?
No.
Was there anything unusual about his behavior at that time?
No.
And we do know that Nicole had a party of 10 that were on their way to Mezzaluna, the restaurant where Ronald Goldman worked. They had reservations at 6:30. They showed up about 6:45. Party of 10 was seated inside, and Ronald Goldman, upon seeing that it was Nicole and her party, he said he didn't want to wait on the table because he knew her. So a waitress by the name of Tia Gavin waited on the table. During Tia Gavin's testimony, she addressed that the party of 10 arrived between 6:45 and 6:50, and that Nicole was wearing the short black dress with a black blazer over it. The check was closed out at 8:18. Tia Gavin testified that it was between 8:30 and 9 o'clock that the party left. We do know that Judy and Lewis Brown left on the San Vicente side of the restaurant, and that's where she dropped her prescription glasses in the street, and they took off back to Dana Point.
That is the location, the former location of Mezzaluna. Now it's something else. It has been a few things over the years, but that's where Ron Goldman worked and where Nicole and the family came night of the murders.
Nicole, the kids, and Sydney's friend named Rachel Berman walked across the street and went to Ben and Jerry's ice cream and got some ice cream. Traffic is pretty loud here on San Vicente, but here's the location of where Ben and Jerry's was, Suite 101, where Nicole and the kids and Sydney's friend Rachel Berman came after they ate at Mezzaluna. They walked into this right here, got some ice cream, and took it home. Now, Rachel Berman, that's an interesting side note. She was supposed to spend the night at the 875 South Bundy residence that night with Sydney. They were going to have a little mini slumber party. So we know that Rachel's father called the residence and said, hey, he's got to pick up Rachel after all. She can't spend the night. And he goes to pick her up, and from about 9 to 9:15, him and Nicole talk, and then he takes Rachel, and they leave. And that's an interesting piece of, I guess, trivia, if you want to call it. I think that it's a big what if, because what if Rachel had spent the night? Now, I know when I had slumber parties as a kid, you know, we would stay up late, be in different parts of the house, hanging out. So Rachel and Sydney could have potentially been awake during the murder, and potentially could have seen something, you know, or maybe even stopped it if, you know, the assailant had seen them in the living room, or they could potentially have been in danger themselves. So at 9:37, one of the employees there at Karen Crawford receives a phone call from Judy Brown stating that she thinks she left her prescription glasses there, or she dropped them somewhere near the restaurant. So Karen Crawford tells her to hold on. She walks outside, and in the gutter street area on the San Vicente side of the restaurant are Judy's glasses. So Karen picks them up, comes back inside, tells Judy she's found them, hangs the phone up, puts the prescription glasses in an envelope, seals the envelope, and writes, "Prescription glasses, Nicole Simpson, will pick up Monday." Traffic was extremely loud to get any kind of good audio here. Here we are at the corner of San Vicente and Gorham, where the Mezzaluna restaurant once stood. And this is the San Vicente side here. This is where Judy Brown dropped her prescription glasses into the street gutter on the San Vicente side of the restaurant. It was in this area right here. Now, a few minutes later, she receives another call. Karen Crawford.
About how long after the first phone call did you get the second phone call?
About 5 minutes.
Would you estimate then about 9:45?
Yes.
Did you recognize the person who called you?
Yes, I did.
Who was that?
It was Nicole.
Nicole?
Yes.
And where were you in the restaurant when you got that call?
I was standing near the bar. Both of our phones are on the bar, so I was at either one end or the other.
And you had a conversation with Nicole?
Yes.
Was it concerning the glasses?
Yes.
Did she ask you to do something with respect to those glasses?
She told me... Well, can you repeat that?
Yeah. Did she ask you to do something with those glasses?
No. She asked if she could speak to Ron, but she didn't tell me what to do with the glasses.
Okay. Ron Goldman?
Yes.
And did you then speak to Ron Goldman?
Yes.
What did you do?
I went over to where he was sitting and I told him that he had a phone call.
Did he speak on the phone?
He did, yes.
Could you hear what he was saying?
No, I didn't hear exactly what he was saying, no.
But you could tell he was speaking?
Yes.
Now, when he came over to take the phone, was he still wearing his waiter's uniform?
No, he wasn't.
How did he look different?
He had taken his vest and his tie off.
Other than that, what was he wearing?
He was wearing black pants and white up on top.
White dress shirt?
Yeah.
So he was still wearing that much of the uniform?
Yes.
Now, after he spoke for a while on the phone, what did he do?
He hung around for a couple of minutes, and then he asked me to give him the glasses, and I did.
After he hung up the phone, did Ron say something to you?
Yeah, he told me he was going to drop the glasses off at Nicole's.
Did he tell you he was on his way to somewhere?
He was on his way to meet a couple of guys from work at Baja Cantina.
And do you know where Baja Cantina is?
Yeah.
Where is it?
It's in Marina del Rey.
So did you give him the envelope with the glasses?
Yes.
Did you see him leave the restaurant at some point?
Yes, I did.
Do you recall about what time it was?
He left at about 10 minutes to 10.
Do you recall what exit he left through?
He left through the side exit that goes out onto Gorham.
Ron clocks out at 9:33 p.m., but he doesn't leave right away. He hangs out with a couple of the managers, a Richard Arbolino and a John DiBello, Karen Crawford.
Okay. Do you recognize what's being shown there?
Yes, it's a time card.
All right. And is that Ron Goldman's time card?
Yes.
And that's for the week ending June the 12th?
Yes.
Can you see Sunday, June the 12th indicated on that card?
Yes.
And it shows that he came in what time?
He came in at 4:30.
And that he clocked out at what time?
He clocked out at 9:33.
Okay. Then he was hanging around the restaurant for a while before he actually left when you saw him leave at about 9:50.
Yes.
He takes off his tie, takes his vest off, loosens up, gets a bottle of water, mineral water, and hangs out and leaves probably around 9:45 to 9:50-ish. He leaves out of the Gorham side of the restaurant and heads to his apartment, which is only just over 300 yards away. He goes home. We can presume that he changed. It was found in the autopsy that Ron had some type of salad. So we know that his clothes were found draped over the door. So you figure if he leaves at 9:48 to 9:50, gets home, let's call it 9:55 to 10 o'clock, borrows his friend's car, and Andrea Scott borrows her car and drives it to Nicole's and parks on the east side of her back alley to return the glasses. And we all know what happens then. Now, that puts it just after 10. So anywhere from 10 to 10:15, I believe that's when Ron arrived there.
White dress shirt. What appears to be a black pair of dress pants. Recognize what we're showing you here?
Yes.
What is it?
It's Ron's shirt and pants.
During testimony, though, John DiBello, the manager, he thought he saw Karen Crawford pick the glasses up off the sidewalk on San Vicente, but Karen Crawford confirmed that no, it was in the gutter pavement walkway area on San Vicente is where Judy dropped him getting into her vehicle.
Okay, Ms. Crawford, do you recognize what's being depicted in this photograph?
It's an envelope.
Does it appear to be the same envelope that you placed the glasses of Mrs. Brown in on the night of June the 12th and that you gave to Ron Goldman to take to Nicole?
It looks like it, yes.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Now, the Ben & Jerry's was across the street from Metzaluna, and like I said, the group walked across the street and grabbed some ice cream, and the ice cream is a key factor too, well, a potential key factor, because we know that it was found on the bottom of the banister leading to the garage from inside of the condo. The spoon was on the floor, so it had melted. So somebody left it there. So I remember the day it happened, June 12th, 1994. I was 19. And I just remember seeing the news coverage on it. And, of course, you get more familiar with it, and your interest grows. And I remember it was growing fast back then, because even back then, we would drive down to the crime scene and to OJ's. And back then, it was, you know, a lot different than now. I mean, that was 26 years ago. But back then, I remember when we first went to Bundy, the walkway was accessible to a point because they had a bunch of potted plants. You know, the plants that you'd buy like at Lowe's or Home Depot, they'd come in those black, you know, holders. They had a bunch of those crossing or filling up the walkway. so it was blocking anyone from walking on there. But you could still see through the gate. It was surreal to see. The back alley on the west side of her condo, that was accessible because that's like an in and out for everyone to pass through and park their vehicles. So we were able to go there. Another time we went, we were able to walk right up to the gate. You know, this could have been several months after, and we were able to do that. And OJ's, you know, that was a circus going over there. I'd been there a few times. The case continues to draw interest from me. I don't think it's ever really going to go away. It's one of, arguably, the most popular, you know, double murder slash murder in LA history, and arguably American history, considering who it was that was accused of this crime, O.J. Simpson.
What you are looking now is a police chase of Simpson and his friend Al Cowling. The finish to this bizarre case began with that picture you're looking at now. Roughly 18 police cars picking up Simpson's trail as he and another man, Al Cowling, rode along a Los Angeles freeway in that white Ford Bronco that you see in the center of the screen and that you see now turning into the driveway of O.J. Simpson's home. That's when the pursuit began to end. During the hour-long journey along the city's highways, the L.A. highways, Simpson was said to be seen riding in the back seat holding a gun to his head. The driver is his old friend and former teammate at USC and with the Buffalo Bills, Al Collings. All this capped a day in which the L.A. District Attorney announced that O.J. Simpson would be charged with two murders, and instead of surrendering as promised, Simpson fled. And his lawyer later told reporters that he feared that Simpson was suicidal.
Alan Park, the limousine driver that night for O.J., was slated to be at Rockingham by 10:45 to pick O.J. up and take him to the airport for an 11:45 flight. Park wanted to be to 360 Rockingham by 10:35, just to be about 10 minutes early. He ended up getting there at 10:22 to 10:23. Alan Park, because he's a limo driver, he stated that he's always looking at the clock because he's got a, you know, he's got deadlines to pick up people, drop people off, flights to make, so on and so forth. So his timing is precise. It's accurate. He heads northbound on Rockingham, passes the Rockingham gate by mistake, so then makes a right heading eastbound onto Ashford. And at that point, he decides that the Ashford gate is going to be easier for him to navigate through when he picks up OJ. So he continues eastbound on Ashford, makes a U-turn, and heads westbound back on Ashford and parks on the north side of Ashford across the street from the Ashford gate. In which point he gets out, goes to the back of the vehicle, smokes a cigarette, sits back down in the car when he's done with his cigarette, listens to the radio for a bit, at which point it is now 10:25. At 10:39, Park heads westbound on Ashford, makes a left onto Rockingham heading southbound, puts the car in reverse heading northbound back on Rockingham, and makes a left turn heading eastbound on Ashford and noses into the Ashford gate. It is now 10:40. Alan Park.
When you pulled up to the Ashford gate, sir, the location shown by the green arrow, can you tell us what time it was?
That was at 10:40.
And how do you know that?
Because I looked at the clocks again.
I'm sorry?
I looked at my watch and the clock again.
And the clock?
Yeah.
You looked at your clock and your watch a lot that night.
A lot.
Why is that?
Because when you're a limo driver, you're set pretty much on schedules. So you're looking to see if you're on time, how long you have to get to the airport, things like that.
Now, you indicated, I think, that you turned off your headlights and you left only your parking lights on?
Yes.
All right. At 10:40,
yes.
What happened next?
That is when I got out of the car, and there is an intercom at the gate, and I was using that intercom to buzz the house, and I buzzed it, and there was no answer. I proceeded to buzz it a few more times. There was still no answer. So I, that's when I decided to get back in the car and call my boss's voicemail.
And calls his boss, Dale St. John. Now, Dale St. John was the normal, regular driver for OJ, but he couldn't work that night. So he pages St. John and then buzzes again. No answer. It is 10:43 now when Park gets back out of the vehicle after paging St. John and buzzes it again. No answer. At 10:46 and 30 seconds, Park calls his mother, who is at his father's house, to get Dale St. John's home phone number. At 10:49, Park calls Dale St. John at his home. There is no answer. He hangs up, gets out, buzzes the intercom again. No answer. At 10:52, Park's phone rings, and it is Dale St. John, and they have a conversation for 2 minutes and 55 seconds. This is all verified and confirmed by phone records. And within that 2 minutes and 55 seconds, St. John tells Park that OJ usually runs late. And he asks Park, is there a light? Can you see if there's a light on downstairs in a pantry area, which is where OJ usually watches television? Park tells St. John, no, there's maybe a light on upstairs, but other than that, the house is dark. During the phone call between St. John and Park, Park can see Cato through the gate emerging on the Ashford side of the house. At the time, he didn't know who that was. He had never met Cato. So anyways, he sees a man coming out, white male with a flashlight, looking around, looking back towards the Rockingham side. We all know now that's Cato investigating those 3 thumps that he heard that could potentially have been an earthquake or a prowler. Park and St. John end their phone call at 10:55 and 12 seconds, all confirmed by phone records. Also during the phone call, behind Cato, there is a 6 foot, 200 pound black male in black clothes emerge near the Rockingham driveway and where the entrance of the house meet. This figure crosses over the entrance and walks into the house. This figure walks into the front door. Alan Park talks to his boss for about 30 more seconds and hangs the phone up, in which point Park gets out, buzzes the intercom again, and within seconds, it's OJ, and says he overslept, he's going to take a shower, he'll be down in a few. Alan Park.
When did you first see this person?
It was almost simultaneously. It was seconds after I saw him.
And this 6 foot, 200 pound African-American person in all dark clothing, was this person moving quickly or slowly?
Not quickly, not slowly. A good pace walk, it seemed to be.
And moving in what direction, sir?
Into the house, or towards the house.
Did you form an opinion as to whether this was a male or female?
No.
And when you saw that person, did that person walk into the entrance?
Yes.
After that person walked into the entrance, what did you do?
I then proceeded to, I was still talking to Dale at the same time. I said, somebody's here. He said, fine, finish the job, take him to the airport, and I'll see you tomorrow or whatever. I hung up the phone and I still waited another 30 seconds or so before I got out of the car. But before that, I was still waiting for somebody to open the gate. I figured somebody was going to come open the gate for me.
Okay.
They still didn't.
How long after you saw the 6 foot, 200 pound person in all dark clothing go into the house did you continue to talk to Dale St. John?
Oh, it was just anywhere between 10 to 30 seconds. It wasn't very long.
So on the phone bill in front of you, sir, and that last call where it indicates 10:52 and 17 seconds, does it indicate how long the phone call was for, the duration of the call?
Yes, 2 minutes and 55 seconds.
Okay, and does that comport with your memory of the length of the phone call?
Yes.
So you would have hung up with him at 10:55 and 12 seconds?
Yes.
And it was within the last 10 to 30 seconds of that call at 10:50, of ending that call at 10:55, that you saw this 6 foot, 200 pound person go into the entrance?
Yes.
After you hung up with Dale St. John, you said you sat for another 30 seconds or so?
Yes, I did.
Why was that?
This is leading, suggesting you cover this.
That was foundational, Your Honor. He's...
Sustained.
After you... You indicated that you sat for another 30 seconds. Why did you sit for another 30 seconds in your car after you hung up?
Because I was waiting for the gate to be open. I figured somebody's home, they saw me, and they're gonna let me in.
And did Cato Kalin come over to let you in?
No, he didn't.
And did the 6 foot, 200 pound person dressed in all dark clothing come to let you in?
No.
And after 30 seconds, what did you do?
That's when I got back up and out of the car and rang the intercom. This time there was an answer, which was Mr. Simpson. He told me that that he overslept and he just got out of the shower and he'd be down in a minute.
How many times did you have to ring the buzzer this time before it was answered?
Director, the formal question. How many times did you have to ring the buzzer?
Oh, well, you can answer the question.
Can you repeat it?
How many times did you have to ring the buzzer this time before it was answered?
Oh, it was just, he answered it pretty much immediately.
As soon as you rang?
Yes.
Just after the acquittal, OJ did a video himself called OJ the Interview, where he gives you his side of the story and he takes you into the house and out and around the house, kind of explaining his side of everything. And here's a piece from that.
As I walk down my driveway, as you can see, it's easy to see me. Alan Park testified on the stand that he had a view from the end of my garage right up here, actually to the front of my house. And this is, I guess, represents some of the biggest frustration I had, not only during the trial, but after the trial, when Marsha Clark tried to create some impressions that, fortunately, the jury didn't buy it. Unfortunately, the pundits bought it. They sold it to you and a lot of people out there. I see in interviews that we do, a man on the street, they ask this question. You notice that Ross Becker asked me, who's the shadowy figure that came across the driveway? Bill Curtis, who did a very fine 2 hours on A&E, even felt, I asked a question at one point about a shadowy figure coming down the driveway or across the lawn and entered the house. One guy even said, who was the guy Alan Park saw climb the wall? The facts are, nobody, at no time, I should say, did Alan Park indicate that he saw anybody climb the wall, come down a driveway, cross a lawn, or even come across the driveway. That was a figment of Marsha Clark's, in her mind, and she tried to sell that to you, and unfortunately, a lot of you people bought that. What Alan Park testified to, that there was a person that was right about here. He put an X on an exhibit to prove it. Right here was where my golf bags were placed, where I walked out of my house, put my suit bag down, looked into my golf bag. When he was let into my property by Cato Kalin and they arrived here, right here was a suit bag, which Alan Park thought was a duffel bag. As we know now, it was a suit bag. Later on, you saw me on the plane and got off the plane with it. And my golf bag, that's all he saw. In the time he arrived here was 10:20. I guess he was here until after 11 o'clock. That is the only activity outside of my house that he witnessed.
Well, the problem with that, in my opinion, is it's completely inconsistent with what Alan Park testified to after the phone call ended, per phone records, at 10:55 and I believe 12 seconds, somewhere in there. It was just before that hang-up is when Alan Park saw that figure come across the entrance area and then into the entrance of the home. After Park buzzed again, OJ answers the intercom, saying that he overslept, he just got out of the shower, and he'll be down in a minute. And that's completely inconsistent with what OJ is saying here, that he was outside with his bags. If he was not just getting out of the shower, if he did not oversleep, there would be no reason to say these things. And by the way, nobody was answering the buzzer. Nobody was answering the intercom up until after 10:55. And OJ had a flight to get to. So you would think he'd be listening out for his intercom to, or his buzzer to buzz back. So it's just completely inconsistent with what actually happened that night. Cato opens the gate for Park. Alan Park pulls into the Ashford side of the house and pulls up near the front door area of the home. Now, Alan Park testified that it had been about 5 to 6 minutes after OJ was on the intercom telling him he overslept that OJ emerges from the front door, wearing a white collared shirt and stonewashed jeans, He's carrying what appears to be a garment bag. Cato helps load golf bags. I don't know who loaded the garment bag into the car, but there was a small bag that was resting near OJ's Bentley and that Cato noticed on the ground.
Did you offer to go and get that bag that you marked with, that was marked with a B on this diagram?
That I was going to take it, pack it, yes.
Did you offer to get it for the defendant?
Yes.
What was his response?
He'll get it.
He said he would get it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Cato offered to grab the bag. OJ said, no, I'll get it. You know, of course, that bag has been an object of contention over the years of what was in the bag. It was never recovered, this type of thing. And what we do know, it was not recovered. You know, now as to what happened to that, that's up to speculation. OJ mentions that they have to go, you know, because they are running late. So by that point, it's probably close to 11, right around that time, maybe a little bit after 11. OJ's flight is at 11:45. During the limousine ride, Alan Park testified that OJ mentioned a few times how hot it was. When asked by Marsha Clark if Mr. Park remembers how the weather was that night, he said it was normal June gloom, foggy, probably 68 to 70 degrees. Marsha Clark asked Alan Park if he was sweating himself, and he said no. Now, Park offered to OJ to turn the AC on, and he remembers hearing it turn on. OJ had a window down. OJ, like I said, mentioned how many times he felt that he was hot and that he shouldn't rush, and he feels like he forgot something from the house. They get to the airport at about 11:35. When helping him unload everything from the trunk, Park noticed there was beads of sweat on OJ's forehead. And at that point, OJ took off and caught his flight at 11:45. And, you know, I think this is a very, very important piece of evidence here, that the testimony from Alan Park, because how precise he was with time to go along with the confirmed phone records. So it was about 10:55, we know, is when Park saw this figure near the Rockingham driveway and walking into the house. We know that Cato was out there after he heard the thumps. We know that OJ emerged 5 minutes after he was seen walking into the house. All the lights turned on. This is what Park testified at that point. Once that figure walked into the house, all the lights turned on. Cato testified at about 9:10 p.m. He pretty much invited himself to go to McDonald's with OJ.
So here we are at the McDonald's on Santa Monica Boulevard, where OJ and Cato came the night of the murders. About 9:15, something like that. They come down here in the Bentley, and they are in this very drive-thru. Now, the building has been renovated. There are some changes to the facade, but more or less, this is the drive-thru right here.
After you gave the defendant a $20 bill, what did you next do?
Oh, well, I asked if I could go to McDonald's with him.
And he said?
Yes.
What did you do?
I went to McDonald's with him.
Okay, did you leave?
Yes, we left.
Okay, did you walk through the main house to do that?
Yes, we did.
And what, did you get into a car with him?
Yes.
What car did you get into?
Miss Rolls Royce.
Who drove?
OJ.
The defendant?
Yes.
I think that messed up OJ's plan a little bit of whatever he was going to do. It might not have been murder. It might be just to go down there and down to Bundy and maybe spy on Nicole or something along those lines. But I think when Cato invited himself, OJ kind of had to say, all right, come on. So Cato goes to the McDonald's with OJ on Santa Monica Boulevard. They go in the Bentley, and they arrive at the McDonald's at approximately 9:22. They hit the drive-thru. Now, Cato specifically remembers that at the intersection of 26th and San Vicente, it was between 9:15 and 9:18. Cato remembers that because they were talking about flight times, and he glanced down at the clock. It wasn't a digital clock. It was an analog clock, but he does remember specifically that was the time. So, anyways, they get to McDonald's at 9:22. They order, and on the way back, OJ eats. Cato does not. Cato just, you know, waits. He wanted to wait till he got home. So they get back to Rockingham, approximately 9:36 to 9:38, somewhere in there. 9:40, I've even heard. They pull into the Rockingham side. OJ parks. Cato gets out, and he said that he thought about, you know, going in there to hang with OJ, but he didn't want to invite himself again, you know, so he just grabbed his food, was headed towards his bungalow. He said when he turned back around towards the driveway that OJ was still standing at the driver's side door of the Bentley. So Cato gets back to his room. He makes a phone call to a friend of his named Paul, who he hung up on earlier and said he'd call him back. So he made that good, called Paul back, ate his food. He was messing with a typewriter that he wanted to get working that OJ gave him, and he couldn't get it working. At 10:10, he calls a friend of his named Rachel Ferrara. Rachel had known Cato, I think, for probably 5 months, 6 months, and she had been over to the house before. She had spent the night at the house before. Anyways, they started a phone call at 10:10. During that phone call, probably about 30 minutes in, 35 minutes in, Cato heard the three thumps, the famous three thumps that he heard. Now, he had behind him on the outside of the wall, his wall, was the air conditioning unit. So Cato heard what he thought was three thumps. So he asked Rachel, hey, did we just have an earthquake? And she said no. So he gets off the phone with her and goes outside to look around. And at that point, Cato was pretty scared, you know. Thought maybe it was a prowler outside or something. So after hearing the thumps, talking to Rachel about it, Cato hangs up with her and eventually makes his way outside, looking, you know, in the backyard, the walkway, because, you know, he said a picture had shook. So he comes around the backside of the house towards the Ashford walkway and is kind of slowly looking around, being cautious. He said he was scared. And that is the time that Alan Park sees him while Alan Park is on the phone with his boss, Cato Kalin.
So I made another phone call.
Who did you call?
My friend Rachel.
And what time was it when you called her?
I called her at about 10:10, around there.
During that phone call, did something unusual occur?
Yeah, I heard a noise.
Now, how long had you been talking to your friend Rachel when you heard that noise?
It was probably a half hour into the conversation.
Okay, so about 10:40 or so you heard a noise?
It's about that time.
Can you describe for us the noise you heard, Mr. Kalin?
It was, you know, in my room, it has this wall and it's like that.
For the record, the witness thumped on the witness stand with his fist.
And you hit the witness stand like three times or so. Was that three noises that you heard?
I believe it was three noises. It was thumping.
It sounded like three thumps.
Yes.
And where did the thumps seem to come from?
Right behind the bedroom wall, where my bed would be.
You said you have an air conditioning unit in a hole in the wall?
Yes.
Was it in the same wall that the air conditioning unit was in?
Yes.
Was it near the air conditioning unit that the thumps seemed to come from?
Yes.
What happened when you heard those thumps?
Well, I was on the phone and I said, I asked Rachel, I said, I think we had an earthquake. Do we have an earthquake? And no, she'd said, and I noticed my picture had moved, so I was started thinking that maybe there was a person back there. And then I have this little flashlight, and I was going to investigate.
So there was a picture on that wall also. Is that yes?
Yes, there was a picture.
And that moved when you heard the noises?
Yeah. Almost moved off the wall.
He comes around. He doesn't open the gate right away for Alan. He figures that someone inside will open it. You know, that really wasn't his thing to open the gates. He just lived there. But he eventually does open the gate up, and Park pulls in And they have some small talk about, hey, was there an earthquake? And Park said, no, I don't think so. I didn't feel one. And then at that point, that's when OJ emerges in the white collared shirt with the stonewashed jeans, and they load the bags in and get in the limo and take off.
Which we've heard a lot about. Once again, when I was talking about that A&E two-hour special that I saw the other night on the trial, and Bill Curtis made a point there saying this was a unit that Cato Kalin heard three loud thumps from. Well, Cato Kalin at no time in this trial said that he heard three loud thumps from the air conditioning unit. Once again, that was one of Marsha Clark's theories. She said that. What Cato actually said, and he demonstrated when he was on the stand with the table in front of him, that he heard three loud bumps, sort of like that. Now, I don't know what that could have been. Maybe it was a signal. I have no idea. But he never said that he heard anyone hit this air conditioning unit. That was a theory of Marsha Clark's. Now, let's take a good look at this air conditioning unit. You can see there's some slats here. They face outward. It's head high. So one would think if anyone ran back here in the dark and ran into this unit, that they should have sustained some type of bruise, some type of injury. And of course, if they were bloodied and had blood on them, there should have been some fabric or some blood on that unit. Right down here, about 4 or 5 feet from this unit, is where they found, or where they claim to have found, the glove. One very interesting thing about that glove, there was no debris on it. There was a lot more here then than there is now. And one key thing about that glove, when Furman saw it, he said it was still wet. It was thick. We did some experiments with that with experts, and they all told you that there was no possible way 7 hours later after this crime that that glove could still have blood on it, could still be wet and still be bloody. That was, I think, an experiment that I can't recall now if we really got it into evidence or not, but we know, and the public should know, that that was an experiment that was done, and it proved that that glove should have been dried by that time in the morning. Now, let's go around front again, and I'll show you some more interesting things. One other point I should say, once again, these berries that were here were also at Nicole's house. If someone walked out of that or walkway to the side of her house, and if they went into that Bronco, there should have been some debris, some leaves, some berries. The same should have been detected in my home. I have some very light carpeting, which I'm going to show you in a minute. If someone ran through here and then went right into my house and went up that carpeting, stepping on these berries, one would think there'd be some trace of that on this very light carpeting. Let's go around front.
Did you discuss with the defendant the earthquake that you thought you felt, or the prowler that you thought might be there?
Yes, I did.
What did you say?
I said, OJ, I heard this noise. I thought something might be back there.
Were you still pretty excited about that?
Pardon?
Were you still pretty excited and upset about that?
Yes. So I said, this flashlight, it doesn't work very well. And I need a better one, so I asked the limo driver if he had a flashlight. And he said no, and then I asked OJ, and he said, you go inside and we'll check for one.
And then did the defendant go back in the house?
Yes.
Did you go with him?
Yeah, I was behind him.
What happened then?
Went into the house, and then OJ said, is that the right time? And I was behind him, and I said, yeah. So then he had to catch his flight, so I hurried up, got him good going. I said, come on, you gotta catch the flight. So then he got in the limo.
Now, do you recall having a conversation after you told the defendant about the earthquake, in which you agreed to both search the property?
Yes.
What did he say? What did he tell you?
That we'd check it together.
And then what did you do?
Oh, we're going to get a flashlight, so I didn't get the flashlight. So I never checked on it again.
So you did not separate and go and look around the property?
No.
So now let's get over to 875 South Bundy Drive. During that time, we know a few of the neighbors heard the dog barking at about 10:15, and that's very important. One of the neighbors was Pablo Fenves. Now, Pablo lived on Gretna Green. His back part of the house overlooked the alley that Nicole Brown Simpson's condo was on, so they shared the alley. He was, I don't know, a couple hundred feet north of her, maybe less than that even. So he was able to see her condo, not all of it, just a portion of it. But he said, you know, the 10 o'clock news was on for a few minutes, and it was about 10:15 that the dog started just wailing, barking. It was a different kind of bark. You know, it wasn't a normal bark. You know, it was almost a cry or a howl. Eva Stein lived just north of Nicole's condo. She was the neighbor just north of that. She also testified that she could not sleep. It was about 10:15. The dog was barking. Now, Eva Stein's boyfriend, a Lewis Karp, wasn't home at that point. Now, he gets home from LAX at 10:45. He parks in the garage that's on the alley side of his building and then goes out to Bundy to get his mail. And this was about 10:45 to 10:50, roughly in there. And he said the Akita was outside and being real aggressive. And it actually started coming towards Lewis. So Lewis backed into his side there and closed the gate to protect himself because he said the Akita was going off. So there was another local resident that lived a couple of blocks away from Nicole, a Steven Schwab. He was a dog walker in the area. And every night he had a routine. After the Dick Van Dyke show, he would leave to walk his dog. And we're talking just right after the Dick Van Dyke show. Once it ended, he'd throw the leash on the dog and they would take off. Now, he constructed a route, a 30-minute route that would get him back home every night in time to watch the Mary Tyler Moore show, which started at 11. So it was a precise walk. He testified as he approached the corner of Dorothy and Bundy, he came across the Akita, and he noticed the Akita had blood on its paws, blood on its fur, and this was about 10:55, because from the intersection of Dorothy and Bundy, it was only another 5 minutes or so to get back to Schwab's apartment. So, as he headed north on Bundy, the Akita followed him back to the apartment. Steven Schwab.
But the dog was panting.
The dog was panting, and my wife was there. Why won't it go? Why won't it go where you're taking it? And I said, I don't know, but I can see that the dog is dehydrated. I think, you know, the best thing to do at this point would be to give it some water. Because, again, I didn't know at that point how long the dog had been lost. It could have been weeks for all I know that the dog was wandering and just happened to arrive in this neighborhood. So I decided to bring it back to my apartment and give it some water.
When you first saw the dog and when you were walking with the dog on the street, was it well lit where you saw the dog?
No, it was not well lit. It's a very dark corner.
When you brought the dog back home and you were downstairs with the dog, was there more light?
Yeah, there was more light.
Were you able to observe the dog then more closely, to look at its body, its legs?
I saw the dog more closely at that point.
And what did you notice, if anything, more about the dog?
Well, I noticed, again, that it was dirty and that there was blood on the paws.
Did you notice...
At that point, I would say that the blood was dried.
Did you notice whether there was any blood on the legs of the dog?
There was... The underside of the dog was dirty. And, again, I noticed the blood on the paws, but I didn't think that much about it. My dog has come home with a bloody paw sometimes from stepping on glass or a fight with another dog, so I didn't think that much about that, especially being that it was a lost dog. I had no idea what it had been through at that point.
So the blood on the paws didn't strike you as something to worry about because you thought it might have stepped on glass?
Yeah, except that I noticed that the dog wasn't hurt in any way. Despite that, there was no injury that I could see to the dog. The dog wasn't cut on the paws, but I didn't think much more about it, again, because it could have happened much earlier.
So you didn't see any obvious cuts on the dog to cause that blood?
There were no cuts on the dog at that point. It itself was not bleeding at that point in any way.
And did you see any blood anywhere other than the paws on the dog?
Well, the dog seemed dirty, especially the underside of the dog, the chest of the dog. I don't know myself whether that was blood or mud or dirt, but it was the underside of the dog was dirty.
And the legs?
And the legs. Again, I noticed the blood, and I don't remember noticing any mud, particularly on the legs. I noticed the blood.
Blood on the legs.
Yeah.
He came across, Stephen Schwab did, came across his other neighbor, Sukru Bostepi. Now, Sukru volunteered to take the dog because, you know, Stephen Schwab wasn't having any luck with the dog at his place. So they were friends, they were neighbors. So Bostepi said, hey, I'll take the dog. Now, once the Akita was in Bostepi's apartment, it was extremely restless. It wouldn't stay still. It was frantic. So Bostepi and his wife decided that just before midnight, they'll maybe walk the dog back towards the area where Stephen Schwab found it, which would be the corner of Dorothy and Bundy. Sukru Bostepi.
When you got out of the apartment building area, did you let the dog go in front of you?
Yes.
And where did the dog lead you?
South to Bundy.
And then where?
And then dog passed across the street to Bundy, across the street to the other side, and then start to pull me a lot harder than it was before. And then we walked for a while, and then he stopped, turned right, and just stopped. I turned right too.
So as you proceeded southbound on Bundy, the dog seemed to pull harder and harder?
Yes.
And then it stopped at some point on the sidewalk?
Yes.
The point at on the sidewalk where it stopped, was there a path of any kind?
Yes, it was a path to a house.
To the house?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
So Sukru and his wife, Bettany Rasmussen, take the dog for a walk, and they head south on Bundy. Now, according to Sukru, the dog was pretty much pulling him back south on Bundy, on the side where Nicole's condo was. The dog, the Akita, stops right there in front of the walkway where the Akita lived. And at that point, Sukru and his wife, Bettany, turn and look to the gate, and they see Nicole laying there in a pool of blood. The gate was open.
It was dark.
Can you describe what else you saw in that area where you saw the woman?
There was a lot of blood. I could see only from the street light, which comes from behind. So it was pretty dark. And I have seen only for a quick moment, and I just turned around and never looked at it again.
If the dog had not stopped where it did, would you have looked up the path and seen her?
No.
Was there any light coming from the house near where you saw her lying?
No.
Was there any light coming from the... Excuse me, strike that. If you recall, was there a gate anywhere near where you saw the woman?
That I don't remember. I haven't seen the gate. I've just looked very low level, exactly where she was laying, so...
They run across the street and start knocking on the door of a Elsie Tissatert, an elderly woman that had lived there 51 years. I may have pronounced her last name wrong. But anyways, she didn't answer. So they go to one house north of her and knock on that door, where a gentleman lets them call 911. The actual first call, the first two officers to arrive, Officer Risky and an Officer Tessarez, I believe his name is. I could be pronouncing that wrong. They get there, but they go to Mrs. Tissatert's house first because it was a 911 call. She thought somebody was breaking into the home. So the actual call wasn't for the bodies, the initial response, you know what I mean? It was actually Elsie calling the cops because she thought somebody was breaking in. So the two officers talk to Sukru and his wife, Bettany, and they point them to the bodies. And Officer Risky testified that you know, they only saw Nicole's body at first, so they walk up the grass patch on the south side of the walkway there, so they don't ask to not step in any blood or anything. And, you know, right away, because it was so dark in there, they don't see Ron Goldman laying there. They eventually do, obviously, but that's what they come across, the two bodies. So when asked by Marsha Clark what Bostepi saw when he turned and looked up the walkway, and I quote, "I saw a lady laying down full of blood." Now, there was another dog walker, a man by the name of Robert Heidstra. His normal route, there was a part of it that he would walk past Bundy, but on the east side of the street, as he was coming southbound on Bundy, he could hear the Akita just going off aggressive. So what Heidstra does is he turns around, heads back north, and cuts down an alleyway that is parallel and probably about 250 feet away from Nicole's walkway. So he walks through that alleyway, and at the point where he is directly across, about 250 feet away from Nicole's, he claims to have heard something, maybe even heard the murder. He heard two men arguing. He heard a gate shutting. He heard someone saying, "Hey, hey, 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 hey," or "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa," something along those lines. And that potentially could have been the murder happening.
So right here is where Robert Heidstra was walking his dogs, and he stopped, and he potentially could be the only ear witness to the crime, where he heard someone say, "Hey, hey, hey," and a gate rattling. And this lines up with Nicole's condo right here. So this would be the area.
Now, as he gets to the south end of that alley, he makes a left, Heidstra does, and stops at a tree where he turns around and faces westbound and can see the edge of Nicole's alley. And at that point, he claims a white vehicle, SUV vehicle, came out of the alley, made a left heading eastbound, and then made a right on South Bundy. Now, in speculation, that could have been the Bronco, you know. I don't necessarily think that was the Bronco at that point, just because I don't think OJ would have taken that route, but it's all speculation, right? So according to Heidstra's testimony, it was around 10:35 p.m. he heard the two men arguing across at Nicole's condo. You know, I've heard people say that maybe what Heidstra heard was actually Lewis Karp shutting his gate because the Akita was out there barking. But that time is a little off from when, you know, from what Heidstra says. But then again, it's all approximate times from these witnesses, right? They can only kind of try to pinpoint when it was. The fact of the matter is there was two bodies slain there around that time. There was a dog barking around that time. I think OJ would have pulled in heading northbound. And, you know, if you listen to OJ's hypothetical confession, you know, and if you read the book, he claims he headed north on the alley, made a left, then made a right, and headed home that way. What OJ said his route was, if he did it, right? It's if he did it. All right, so let's get to what we have at Bundy. Now, the first officers arrived probably about 12:01 to 12:05, and investigators poured in after that. You know, Tom Lang, of course, Mark Furman, Van Adder, Brad Roberts. What Tom Lang noticed, and this was just after 4 a.m., I think is when he got there, there was footprints heading in a westward direction with five blood drops tailing west, heading back to the alley where the Bronco was parked. Wherever it was dripping from, it was in motion, right? Of course, there were size 12 Bruno Mollies. You can see from the footprints that the assailant stopped at one point, turned around and looked back towards the bodies, and then continued on. They did a stride analysis, which this is very interesting now. It's a 30-inch distance between each footstep, right? So the stride analysis measures stride in footprints. 30 inches. So what that tells authorities is that the assailant walked away. He didn't even run. To walk away, I think you have some kind of familiarity with the area, which is another reason why I think O.J. parked the Bronco facing north in the alley. As we all know, those five blood drops matched O.J. Simpson's blood. There was blood drop on the gate of the rear exit of the residence. Just outside of the gate, there were two coins on the ground with blood around them, blood drops. And what Lang figured was the assailant pulled his keys out of his pocket and those coins fell out. In regards to what Heidstra said, and I said that I don't think O.J. would go that way, but then again, you're asking for a reasonable explanation of an unreasonable crime, right? So, you know, you can also say, why would O.J. take a big white Bronco at night instead of a black Bentley, you know, if he was going to go do this? Which I think maybe, here's my pushback on that, is maybe he took the white Bronco because Cato kind of messed up the plans to take the Bentley down there, and that if Cato can't see the Bronco from the residence because the Bronco's parked outside on the street. So, you know, maybe that's why he decided to take the Bronco. Because, well, having to go to McDonald's with Cato kind of messes up my timeline. I got a flight to catch, so let me go ahead and take the Bronco down there. Maybe not to commit murder. I don't think he went down there to kill her. You know, I think it escalated to that. But what we do know, like I said, those size 12 Bruno Marlies match the Bruno Marlies that OJ's seen wearing in a few different pictures from a Buffalo Bills game that he was commentating. You can see OJ wearing the Bruno Marlies. You know, that came out in the civil trial. And, you know, I've heard people push back on that, saying, well, that could be doctored. Well, here's the thing with that. Those pictures were taken, obviously, before the murders. They were published in a Buffalo Bills newsletter that was mailed out to Buffalo Bills fans some 9 months prior to the murders. To have doctored Bruno Marley's shoes on O.J. Simpson in a photo 9 months before the murder is ridiculous. Now, in 2006, which they just released the interview last year, O.J. sat down with Judith Regan to talk about, hypothetically, how it went down. He tells you what happened.
The chapter 6, is called The Night in Question. Mm-hmm. And you write in the book, now picture this and keep in mind that this is
purely
hypothetical.
Hypothetical.
Yes. Why don't you tell me what might have happened on the night of June 12th, 1994? And let's just walk through the
night. Well, first of all, this is very difficult for me to do this. It was very difficult for me because it's hypothetical. I know and I accept the fact that people are going to feel whatever way they're going to feel. You know, they're going to, you know, some whatever they want to feel. In the book, the hypothetical is
Charlie.
This guy Charlie shows up, the guy who I'd recently become friends with, and I don't know why you'd been by Nicole's house, but it told me you wouldn't believe what's going on over there. And I remember thinking, well, whatever's going on over there has got to stop, right? So we kind of hooked up together, and you know, I'm kind of broad-stroking this. We go over. Get in the Bronco and go over it.
Let's just go back and do the details. Where did you park?
I'll see the detail.
You park
in the hypothetical in the alley.
Right. You park in the alley.
Yeah.
And you put on a wool cap and gloves.
In the hypothetical, I put on cap and gloves.
Right. Yeah. And you reached under the seat for
a knife. I always kept a knife in the car for the crazies and stuff because you can't travel with a gun. And I remember Charlie saying, you ain't bringing that. And I didn't, right? But I believe he took it.
Charlie took the knife?
Yeah. In the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the back gate, you go through the back gate?
Yes.
And it was open or broken or?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I go to the front and I'm looking to see what's going on. And I can see that it appears like Nicole had candles up all the time. She really did to keep her overhead down, I think. And music was on. And while I was there, a guy shows up.
You know? So Ron Goldman comes in the back gate.
Yeah. A guy I really didn't recognize. I may have seen him around, but I really didn't recognize him to be anyone. And in the mood I was in, I started having words with him.
He says to you, "I just came by to return a pair of glasses. Judy left them at the restaurant."
Yeah, words to that effect, yes.
And I don't know
if I believe it or didn't believe it. It was pretty much immaterial because, you know, I was more concerned about everything that was going on, you know, and was fed up with it, I guess. And you
get into a fight. Nicole comes out.
A verbal fight. Got a little loud, and by that time, Nicole had come out, and we started having words about who is this guy, why is he here, what's going on.
And she says, "This is my house, get that the F out of here."
Yes, which I didn't like, because once again, this is the same person, and if you read the book, you'll see some things that happened in the 2 weeks leading up to this that were very, very irritating, you know. And I think Charlie had followed this guy in, wanted to make sure it was no problem. And he brought the knife. As things got heated, I just remember Nicole fell and hurt herself. And this guy kind of got into a karate thing. And I said, "Well, you think you can kick my ass?" And I remember I grabbed the knife. I do remember that portion, taking the knife from Charlie. And to be honest, after that, I don't remember. Except I'm standing there and there's all kind of stuff around and what
kind of stuff?
Blood and stuff around. I hate to say this, but this is not about alcohol. I'm sorry.
Right.
I know we got to back up again.
It's right. Okay. I want to back
this
up.
This is hard.
This is hard.
Yeah,
I know. I want to back up
to. It's hard to try to make people think that I'm.
I know. You wrote in the book, "I had never seen so much blood in my life." Covered, you're covered, the scene. Can you describe it?
It's hard for me to describe it, I'm telling you. I don't think any two people could be murdered the way they were without everybody being covered in blood. And of course, I think we've all seen the grisly pictures after. So yeah, I think everything was covered, would have been covered in blood.
And what goes through your mind at a time like that?
I don't know. It's like, what happened?
Mm-hmm. You write about removing a glove before taking the knife from Charlie.
I had no conscious memory of doing that, but obviously I must have, because they found a glove there.
And blacking out. Have you ever blacked out before?
Not to my knowledge.
No,
of course. Of course, if something like this would take place in anybody's life, if it were to happen, I would imagine it's something that you would probably automatically have trouble wrapping your mind around it. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible.
I think he made a few things up, a few small things up, but he tells you what happened. And, you know, and as you can see from that, you know, a lot of that to me is truthful. He takes the Bronco down to the alley with this Charlie guy. He gets out of the vehicle without Charlie, walks in through the back gate, and then he hears the back gate open up, which is interesting because for 25 years I always assumed that Ronald Goldman came in through the front gate. But you know, you find out that he parks the car that he borrowed on the east side of the back alley, so maybe he was that comfortable. You know, I do know that the front gate had a malfunction on it. It wasn't fully functional. He comes in through the back gate, according to what OJ says, and that Ron says, "Hey, I'm here to return some glasses." OJ and Ron have some words. OJ says that Ron gets into a karate stance, and OJ's like, "Oh, you think you can take me?" There's a scuffle. Now, OJ kind of just broadly says there's a scuffle and that Nicole ends up falling. And we do know from the lack of any blood on the bottom of Nicole's bare feet that she went down first. Now, OJ does say that he grabs the knife from Charlie and then he blacks out. When asked during the interview, did he drop the glove there? OJ says, well, I must have because they found a glove there. Now, see, the problem with that is he's mixing a hypothetical scenario with reality. So he's saying hypothetically he dropped a glove there, and it's mixed into it really was found there. So that there's a huge problem with this hypothetical. You know, he's almost speaking like it's not hypothetical. I saw this. I was there. I saw Ron. Ron did this. Then he said he came to, and he said there was blood everywhere. And him and Charlie take off. He's got to get rid of the clothes. I think he said he left his keys and I think his wallet in the pants. He had to go back and get them. And then he says he gets dropped off on the street behind him and cuts through the neighbor's yard and then into his yard. And I think that's, I don't know that I believe that, because the Bronco was parked in front of Rockingham. And I would think if he's dropped off on the back street, then this Charlie guy would have to park the Bronco on the front and then take off in whatever vehicle he was in. So I think Charlie was totally made up. I think that OJ actually lucked out a few times that night. He lucked out that Alan Park was parked on the Ashford side on the phone with his boss when OJ was heading north on Rockingham. I think OJ hit the lights on the Bronco, pulled in there real slow, and either hopped his gate or somehow opened it maybe and squeezed in there without making too much of a commotion, all while Alan Park was on the Ashford side. Now, if Alan Park was on the Rockingham side gate, I think he would have seen OJ pull up in the Bronco, and then there would have to be some explanation for that.
All right, we're here in front of OJ's old residence. It's been torn down since, but right now we're actually parked where the Bronco was parked that night. This is Ashford and Rockingham.
Another stretch of luck was Lewis Karp. Now, remember, Lewis Karp and Eva Stein lived just next door, north of Nicole. His flight from LAX was supposed to land a half an hour sooner, and it got delayed. So he got home at 10:45. Now, if you theoretically do all the math, if his flight wasn't a half hour late, he would have pulled in to the alley at 10:15. 10:15 was when the dog was barking crazy. I think Lewis Karp could have potentially seen the Bronco there if his flight wasn't late, you know. So there's two stretches of luck there, I think, that helped out in the case. Not to say that he would have been convicted anyway, but there was too much DNA. I mean, he had a DNA blood trail from Bundy, from the crime scene of Bundy, leaving Bundy in his Bronco, up his driveway, in his walkway, through his foyer, up into his bedroom. Another key point, and I stress this when I talk about this to people, you know, that the whole idea of planting blood, you know, I can listen to that argument. I can listen to it if we're talking about Rockingham. But you got to remember that those five blood drops leaving the bodies, right, alongside the left side of the size 12 Bruno Mollies. And by the way, OJ had a big nick in his middle finger on his left hand that during the interrogation, he came up with three different reasons as to why he was bleeding. So it is acknowledged that he was bleeding. That's his blood. But remember, those five blood drops walking away from the crime scene, heading west, those were there when OJ was on a flight to Chicago and in Chicago. So in other words, there was no blood to withdraw from him from LA to plant on Bundy, which is why during closing arguments, the defense, they didn't accuse the LAPD of planting those, you know. There was questions about blood on the gate, on the back gate. Of course, questions about blood planting in the Bronco and at Rockingham. And to be fair, Philip Van Adder, one of the lead detectives, he was seen bringing OJ's vials of blood to the Rockingham estate. And Shapiro grilled him about that. I don't think it was planted. I think it was just a mistake. Now, the criminalist was there at Rockingham, but I don't think Van Adder should have brought that blood there just because of, you know, the scrutiny and how it came back to haunt him. But to be clear, the blood at Bundy was there before they withdrew any blood from OJ, and I don't think you can get away from that, you know. I think OJ went there, and I think what he described in his hypothetical, if you take away a few things here and there, like Charlie walking in after Ron Goldman walks in, you take that away, I think he tells you what happened. I don't think that, like I said, I don't think that he was dropped off on the street behind him. I think he actually pulled into Rockingham. Now, what I think happened, OJ went over there, he's arguing with Nicole, Ron comes in, and during the scuffle, Nicole is hit on the top of the head, as we can see from the autopsy. She's knocked down, and then OJ and Ron square off, and we've all seen the grisly shots. From that point, OJ walks back to the Bronco, bleeding, gets in the Bronco, drives it back to Rockingham, heading north on that alleyway, hits the headlights, parks the Bronco really quiet because he knows that Park is on the other side, on the Ashford side of the property. OJ squeezes in through the gate or potentially hops it. I think he squeezes in. I don't think he opens it mechanically because I think it would make too much kind of noise. Then I think OJ walks on the south side of the house, which is a skinny little walkway where the AC unit is, hits the AC unit. Cato hears that thump and goes through the back. Right? When he gets to the back, he realizes that the alarm is set. So now he has to head back to the front of the house. He heads back down to the front of the house and emerges on the Rockingham side of the driveway and crosses the entrance into the house where he can only disarm the alarm from the inside of the house.
On the way to the airport, did the defendant say anything to you?
Yeah, a few times he repeated how hot he was. Two or three times he said, you know, man, it's hot. And I told him that he can turn the air conditioning on.
And did he?
Which I remember hearing it come on, yes. He also had the seat that he was sitting in, he also had the window down. A couple times, you know, he repeated it doesn't pay to get dressed in a hurry or something like that, or I know I forgot something. I said that usually happens when you're going on a trip. Asked me what time it was.
Mr. Park, let me ask you something. How many times... Well, he's on a narrative. If you don't mind, I'll ask him the next question.
Excuse me, counsel, I thought we agreed we were going to talk to me. Thank you. Chrissy.
How many times did the defendant remark to you that he was hot?
He said it pretty quick, right in a row, two or three times.
And then after the air conditioning and the window were down, did he continue to repeat he was hot?
Sustained phrase question.
Did he remark on being hot again after the air conditioning was on and the window was down?
Did he remark?
Did he say it again?
No.
Do you recall what the weather was like that night?
From what I remember, it was mild, having our normal June gloom, foggy nights.
About what? About what was the temperature, if you recall?
68, 70 degrees, I don't know.
Were you sweating?
No, I wasn't.
Were you hot?
No. All of them said they were busy. So I walked into the terminal part and grabbed a luggage cart.
And when you went to get the sky cap, did you bring the garment bag with you or did you leave it at the car?
No, I set it on the ground.
And when the defendant got out of the limousine, sir, could you observe him? Was there lighting there that you could see him?
Yes.
Did he get out of the car as soon as you pulled up to the terminal?
I don't know if it was as soon as we got there. I know it was pretty quick after we pulled up.
When you got out of the car after you parked there, did you see him out of the car? Did you see him get out of the car?
Yeah, I opened the door.
Oh, you opened the door for him?
Yes.
Okay. And then he got out?
Yes.
Could you tell whether or not he looked sweaty?
Sustain, rephrase the question.
Could you tell us how he looked? How did he appear?
He seemed to be hot.
And what did you see that made you believe that?
He had a little bit of sweat on his forehead.
So like I said, for me, June 12th and June 13th are the most interesting part of this case because that's the actual timeline. I mean, we're all going to come to our own conclusions about it, but that's what I think happened. I think OJ took that small bag with the potential murder weapon in it and whatever else was in it to the airport or dumped it somewhere else to get rid of it. Maybe even hid it on the property of Rockingham. I mean, we're never going to know that, but I do not believe there was a Charlie involved. I don't believe there was a second person there because I don't think somebody can hold their mud this long. You know, I don't think that some guy that OJ just barely casually knew wasn't going to open his mouth at this point, especially for money or something, and say, hey, OJ threatened me to go with him up there, and this is what happened. I think OJ went there by himself, as he's done before. I mean, he watched that guy Keith and Nicole mess around in the Gretna greenhouse. He watched through the window. He's probably done it numerous times. But this night, you know, turned into something totally different. And it's a case that has continued to grow from old generation to new generation. There are countless documentaries and TV specials regarding this case. The best one that I've seen is the 30 for 30, OJ Made in America, directed by Ezra Edelman. And it's a fair five-part documentary that it tackles both sides from before the murders to after the murders. And I think it's pretty objective in regards to the case. So I would recommend taking a look at that one. The American Crime Story that they did on FX, that started out okay, but I just felt that they got a few things wrong right off the rip, and it kind of rubbed me the wrong way, I guess. The first thing would be when they found Nicole's body. It was found by a guy walking his dog, and he came across the Akita who was already at the front gate of Nicole's, and that's not how it went down. Nowhere near how it went down, you know, and I think they should have got that right, especially when you're going to open it up to that murder. You got to get that right. Secondly, when Alan Park picks up OJ in the American Crime Story version, the limousine is down on the street. OJ walks down there, loads the limo there, and that couldn't be further away from what happened. Alan Park pulled into the premises, pulled into the driveway on Ashford, and was adjacent to OJ's front door, and they loaded the vehicle there. They really got that wrong. That's just inaccurate. I mean, there's little things like that that you just got to get right. So we're going to come to a close here on this 2S Horror Quarters podcast, another Ghost of L.A. edition. Shout out to Sammy Reese, whose song Ghosts of L.A. helped inspire these true crime episodes. So thank you, sir, for that. I appreciate everyone tuning in. And we'll see you next time. On June 12th, 1994, in the Brentwood section of West Los Angeles, two people were brutally slain in the front courtyard of 875 South Bundy Drive. One Ronald Lyle Goldman, age 25, and one Nicole Brown Simpson, age 35. Just after midnight on June 13th, 1994, their bodies were discovered by a local resident. Los Angeles, already well established throughout history, would somehow be put on the map again.
Okay, we're here at Pierce Brothers in Westlake Village at the gravesite of Ronald Lyle Goldman, who of course died on June 12, 1994. And we wanted to come here and pay our respects to him. Thanks a lot, brother. We are at Ascension Cemetery, where Nicole Brown Simpson and her father are buried. Just here to pay our respects again. Since a tragic death.
Where we hide, you better make a run. We're coming out tonight with ghosts.